You're listening to Rotary Radio UK, and this is Steve Wood. My guest is cricket author Mike Thompson. Mike, hello.
Good morning.
And your latest publication is The Last Corinthian, and it's about
MJK Smith, Mike Smith, about his cricketing life rather than a complete biography. Mike was captain of Warwickshire from the age of 23 for 11 years and captain of England for about 4 years in the early 1960s. He was essentially a batsman, but he was regarded as one of the best captains England has had in terms of his people management ability and his ability to motivate players.
Why did you choose Mike Smith as a candidate for this book?
I was considering writing a biography of a cricketer. I'd already written a cricket book about 5 years ago on a long-dead cricketer, Lord Frederick Beauclerk, who played around about 1800 and was the leading amateur cricketer in the underarm era. But I knew Mike personally from about 1973, because when I lived in Coventry, I was a member of his squash club, which he opened in a little village called Leek Wootton near Kenilworth in Warwickshire, and was and got to know him over the 5 years that I was a member there.
So were you constantly in contact with him during that
period? No, not at all. In fact, I contacted him again. I found out where he lived. I use a website, 192, which, if you know the name of the person and an idea of where they live, then you can find out their address. It's not so easy when somebody's called Smith, because there's a lot of them, but there's not many MJK Smiths. So I wrote to him, and he very kindly came back to me and said, yes, I'd be interested in your writing a biography of me, of my cricketing career, which was somewhat of a surprise, because a chap called Douglas Miller had written a very good biography of him in 2013, entitled MJK Smith, No Ordinary Man. But that was basically a biography of his, not only of his cricket playing career, his administrative career afterwards, his rugby career, and his personal life. All I wanted to cover basically was his cricketing career as a player. I didn't particularly want to cover his administrative career afterwards, which was also quite distinguished.
I mean, just to take you off on a tangent just for a moment, because he did actually play rugby for England, didn't he?
He did. He when he was at university, in his final year at university, he developed a brilliant partnership with the scrum half, a guy called, I think, Owelyn Brace, who became a Welsh rugby international. And they, in 1956, revolutionised halfback play. And on the strength of that, Mike was picked for England for the match against Wales to partner Dickie Jeeps, who was the England scrum half then. Unfortunately, Mike didn't have a particularly good game. England lost, I think it was 8-3 to Wales. And part of the defeat was a result of Mike going for a drop goal, which got charged down, and Wales scoring from it. So he was never picked again. But being the sort of chap he is, an incredibly modest chap, I asked him on one occasion, I said, did you feel bitter at all about only being given one chance? And he said, no, not really. He said, I had a bad game.
Okay. And I think during the writing of the book, you had quite a lot of contact with his playing contemporaries.
Extensive contact with them, yeah. one of the first things I did when I went to see Mike, and I actually stayed with him at his flat in Warwick, was to ask him, you know, if he'd got contact details for his living contemporaries for that era, and he very kindly gave me the names of six of his Warwickshire teammates. Alan Smith was vice-captain to Mike when Mike was captain, and later took over the captaincy of Warwickshire when Mike retired for the first time. Jim Stewart, Bob Barber, Dennis Amis, David Brown, and John Jameson.
Ah,
John,
yes.
Jameson. Yeah. You know, he rang five of them. Bob Barber lives in Switzerland, so he didn't ring him, but he gave me Bob's address. He gave me Bob's address in England and in Switzerland, and I sent an email to Bob. Oh no, I sent a letter to Bob to his English address, and I didn't get a reply for quite a while because he was in Switzerland at the time. And he came back to me. He was a little bit suspicious because Mike hadn't introduced me to him. He'd never heard of me. He asked me if I was a blogger, whatever that is. And anyway, I managed to convince him of my credentials, and he agreed to meet me, as did all the other five. And I had very interesting meetings with all five, all six of Mike's Warwickshire teammates, who gave me a lot of interesting information and anecdotes.
Yeah. You called the book The Last Corinthian. Corinthian, to me, is another word for amateur.
Yeah.
He was a professional, wasn't he?
Well, no, he wasn't. Mike was an amateur.
Oh, right.
He was... there was a bit of a blurred line between amateurism and professionalism then. I mean, Mike was an amateur. He distinguished himself, first of all, at Oxford by scoring centuries in each of the three varsity matches he played in, which had never been done before. In his first 2 years at Oxford, Mike was born in Leicestershire, and in his first 2 years at Oxford, he played for Leicestershire. But then Warwickshire came along and offered him the captaincy of Warwickshire, but he wasn't able, the MCC wouldn't allow him to go straight away. In those days, you had to take a year out before you could change counties. So Mike took a year out, and he joined Warwickshire immediately on leaving university at the age of 23, and captained them for 11 years.
Yeah.
He took over, incidentally, from Eric Hollies, the famous English leg spinner, who was responsible for ruining Don Bradman's average, because he got Bradman out for a duck in Bradman's last test when Bradman only needed four to have a test match batting average of 100.
Yeah.
In the end, he finished up with 99.4.
Yeah.
The Corinthians were renowned for playing sport for the love of the game as amateurs and for their, you know, for the sporting way in which they played sport.
Yeah.
And the title didn't come to me immediately. It came to me, you know, towards the end of my writing the book, because that, to my mind, perfectly embodies Mike Smith, because he was a very fine player. He was an amateur, but he was one of the most sporting players imaginable. Mm. He never did anything mean or underhand. He always walked if he thought he'd hit the ball.
Yes.
He was a complete sportsman in the true sense of the word.
There's quite an anecdote in there. I think they were in Australia. One of the Australian batsmen refused to walk.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
That would have been Bob Cowper, I think.
Yes, I think Cowper, that's right.
Cowper was a non-walker.
Because the ball hit his boot, I think.
Actually, that was in South Africa.
Oh, South Africa.
That was Eddie Barlow
in
South Africa.
Yeah.
And that produced quite an incident, quite an interesting confrontation, because Fred Titmuss was the bowler. Fred was a very good off-spinner.
Mm.
Mike, you know, considers that Fred was probably as good an off-spinner as Jim Laker. The figures wouldn't bear that out, but Fred was a very fine bowler, and he could also bat quite well. But he was bowling at Eddie Barlow. A ball came off Barlow's boot and was caught by Peter Parfitt at slip, I think, and Barlow refused to walk. Fred Titmuss then called Barlow a cheat, using, you know, a rude expletive in front of cheat. Barlow then came down the pitch and threatened to hit him with his bat if he said that again. I think at that point Mike intervened to make the peace. But at the end of the day, the England tour manager, Donald Carr, ordered Titmuss to apologise to Barlow. And Titmuss said, "I'm not apologising."
No.
And Donald Carr, to his credit, said, well, he said, "There's a plane leaving for London at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning." He said, "And if you don't apologise, you'll be on it."
Right.
So, according to all reports I've read, Titmuss then did apologise to Barlow, and Barlow accepted the apology. But that is not how I heard it from Peter Parfitt, who I spoke to, because Parfitt told me what really happened. He said the following day, he said he went down. Parfitt was a teammate at Middlesex of Fred Titmuss. He said, "I went down with him to the South African dressing room. We opened the door, and Fred Titmuss said, 'I've come to apologise and I've now done it,' and then just left without waiting for an answer." So that, I think that is the true version of what happened, although it's always been reported differently from that. But that is the value of getting an eyewitness account from somebody who was actually there.
Okay. The question I was coming to around Corinthian, though, is that, you know, obviously he had to live. So if he's playing cricket, he's not being paid for it.
Well, he was actually assistant secretary at Warwick. He was made assistant secretary at Warwick, Warwickshire, where he got paid.
Yeah.
He probably got more than the professionals got, to be honest, because it was a bit of a... The whole thing was a bit of a sham, really.
Yeah.
He was an assistant to Leslie Deakins, who was a very fine Warwickshire secretary for about 40 years.
Right.
But so he did get... He was able to
finance
his life, yeah.
Yeah. OK, and... In the days before they went out to bat with basically a suit of armour on, as they do now, he was playing in a shirt and a sweater and spectacles, which he must have been one of the last to do that.
I think one or two people have played in spectacles, but there's an interesting story attached to that involving Jeff Boycott. When Boycott told me, I contacted Jeff Boycott as an ex-England teammate of Mike, and I didn't hear anything from him for about 2 or 3 months. And I thought, oh, well, he's probably got more interesting things to do than to correspond with me. But I couldn't have been more wrong, because about 3 months later, I got an email from him saying, "I've just come back from Cape Town, and I've been trying to contact you, but the number that you gave me in your letter... It's unobtainable." And the reason for that was that in the meantime we'd moved house and we'd got a different phone number.
Yes.
But he'd still got my email address and he'd contact me through that. So he said, "Phone me tomorrow morning on this number." And he said, "You wanted me to talk to me about Mike Smith." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I just wanted your opinion on what you thought of him as a captain, really." And he said, "Fantastic, best people manager I've ever played under." He said, "And I also owe quite a debt to Mike," he said, "because when I was about 16, he said, I couldn't see what teacher were writing on blackboard," he said. He said, "And I realised I was losing my sight." He said, "So at the suggestion of me Uncle Algy," he even spelt his name out for me, A-L-G-Y, "I wrote to Mike Smith because I knew he played in glasses and asked him what it was like batting in glasses." And he said, "I got a very nice letter back from him within a couple of days saying it's fine to play in glasses." He said, "You just need to make sure you get shatterproof lenses." He said, "And I did that." He said, "And I played in glasses for about the next 5 or 6 years until contact lenses came in," he said. "So I've always been grateful to Mike. He said, and I really wish I'd kept that letter now, but he said, but stupid me, I threw it away, or yeah, I can't find it now.
I do remember seeing, not in the flesh, but pictures of Boycott playing in glasses.
But Mike Boycott's got a very high regard for Mike. Mm. Very high.
And it seems from the stories and the anecdotes in the book, the conversations that you had with people, that Mike Smith is just a very nice man. And we'll take a break from Mike's narrative here, because we've got a couple of illustrations from the book that read by Mike that give you a really good idea of just what a nice chap Mike Smith was.
This is what Fred Titmuss says about Mike. Fred Titmuss was full of praise for Mike and considered him a much better captain than Cowdery or Dexter, especially when it came to field placing. He would have a chat with you and suggest things, and you would come to a joint decision. Ted's idea of a joint decision was him telling you what to do and you doing it. Even Colin Cowdery sometimes liked to direct you and be in charge. That always upsets a bowler. Mike accepted that if you were a test bowler, you probably knew where you wanted your field setting and he would leave it to you. When asked about this, Mike's terse reply was, "You don't want your bowlers to be unhappy, do you?" This is what David Brown said. David Brown was an England fast bowler, one of Mike's Warwickshire teammates. This is what he said. "Mike, for my money, is the best skipper I have ever played with. Without driving, he draws more reserves out of a player than any other captain I've known." He also maintained that a young cricketer could not find a better example on and off the field.
So that's the end of this first excerpt from The Last Corinthian, written by Mike Thompson. And you've been listening to it here on Rotary Radio UK. You can go straight on to listen to part two, which you will find listed under the podcasts on our website, rotaryradiouk.org. Thank you.